Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Today's episode is part two of our conversation with retired Army Sergeant Major Kara Rutter. In part one, Kara shared her unexpected journey through military service, from insisting on becoming a cook to cooking for Secretary Rumsfeld to representing the U.S. military overseas in some of the most strategically important regions of the world. We left off as Kara and her husband Matt had just found their 20-acre farm in Aiken, South Carolina, and were beginning to turn their post-military life into something new. In part two, we pick up with a powerful discussion on food systems, national security, and what it could take to localize protein sourcing for military bases. Kara shares her thoughts on decentralizing food supply chains, the vulnerabilities exposed during COVID, and why she sees food as a matter of strategic defense. We also dive into the creation of Project Victory Gardens, their nonprofit focused on helping veterans become farmers, the success of their farmer bootcamp, and a deeper look into their new agritourism incubator program. If you're interested in how veterans are shaping agriculture, not just for themselves, but for their communities, this episode is for you. Let's get into it.
Meat processing capacity is certainly kind of one of the weak links in our national food chain, because that's not how it's designed. It's not designed for an independent producer of animals to sell at a wholesale level, because the independent meat processors are obviously more expensive than, you know, kind of your big four meat company internal processing systems. And so, you know, it's kind of like everything, right? We sort of buy from the lowest bidder with everything in the military, and so it's difficult to compete at that level. You know, there can be, I think that there can be some kind of niche things that you can certainly strive to set up partnerships between, you know, especially veteran owned businesses and government contracting. Obviously, you know, there are some built-in benefits there. But until, you know, if we were to set up a meat processing facility at, you know, outside all of our major bases, absolutely, you know, it's right. Absolutely feasible. But that's, you know, that's the biggest concern. So interestingly enough, no matter where you are in the world, if you're eating at a military dining hall, whether that's in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever, about 85 at least percent of that food comes from the United States because of the Berry Act. And so, you know, everything that, you know, when I was managing food service for the Army for the Middle East, for the Army Central footprint, everything pretty much except for fresh fruits and vegetables, soda, just because it's just so big and bulky and heavy that we didn't want to ship it, and fresh dairy products would come from the United States, and we would have to, you know, figure out how to get that overseas.
Everything we, except those three except things?
It. Yep.
Okay. Okay. Yep. Is animal protein normally included in that 85% that is sourced?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
US? Yes. Okay.
Yep. And all animal proteins would be sourced from the US.
And now this is not a situation where you go to the grocery store and you buy steaks that say made in the US, but in fact they were only harvested in the US, but they were raised in Brazil or something like that. Is that that situation or not?
So, I mean, there have to be certain declarations from, you know, from the companies that are contracted to sell that these are U.S. produced and sourced products.
Okay.
We actually, quinoa is always kind of the one that I go back to because it became super popular. It's a
Right.
superfood. We've got these young folks that we're trying to feed, and we had a lot of requests for quinoa. And
It's
quinoa is
Middle
not,
Eastern, though. It's a Middle Eastern origin, isn't it? Yeah.
and it's not really grown
Right.
in the United States. And so, I mean, we actually worked really, really hard with some producers and some of the companies that we contracted with to establish, a quinoa source that was a US sourced quinoa.
When you guys put contracts together for beef, for example, are you generally buying from a Sysco or are you buying from the actual meat processing entity itself?
Yeah, so most so all the US military bases, or I'll speak Army specifically, all the Army bases in the United States have a contractor with a local purveyor, whether that's Sysco or
Okay.
Labatt's or one of those other companies. And so we set forth our contract restrictions and expectations, and then they have to source the products. We
Okay.
have a little bit of say in, what we're sourcing. For, when I was focusing on overseas food service, we had a little bit more say. We could make like independent acquisitions of things.
Okay.
There was a sauce that everybody just really liked. Kind of a It was a whole line of sauces, but and line of Indian food. And when we tested it out, in country, everybody loved it. And so, we were able to do some of those more individual things because it was overseas. Obviously, we, when people are in theater, we want to make sure that we're giving them the best, and keeping it updated, and so that they can really enjoy their food over there.
Could you see a pathway where the Army, for example, created slaughter specialist or a harvesting MOS and had this training pipeline of soldiers that would be trained on how to harvest these animals? In addition to adjacent or even on-base slaughter facilities, do you think there would be appetite for this sort of new MOS pipeline?
So I would love that, because ultimately we want to open up our own butcher facility, and the problem is that there's just no trained butchers in the United States. There's not a lot of programs that focus on meat cutting and things of that nature. No, would be the short answer there.
Okay. Okay. Why
So,
not?
anytime you add a new MOS, that comes from somewhere, right? The end
Okay.
strength is set by
Yeah.
Congress. And so if you want to add something new, you have to take it from somewhere else. And everyone is very protective of their fiefdoms. And every time something is added, something else has to go away. When I was, a young soldier at Fort Lee going through training to become a cook, I was told at that time that there is no way that we will be able to retire as cooks in the Army, that they would get rid of Army cooks. I heard that time and time again throughout my career. I did retire as a 92 Golf, as an Army culinary specialist. But there's certainly not really an appetite to expand any of those type of positions, food focused positions. I think that there are opportunities for contracts for something of that nature.
Okay. Why were they telling you that you wouldn't be able to retire with that MOS?
Because if you look at the vast majority of our on-post dining halls
Contracted?
across the footprint, they're all contracted.
Okay. Okay.
And if you look at like the Air Force doesn't send out field cooks. That's not how they're designed. And so typically, because they kind of break it down by services, and so food service is part of Air Force services, but it's not really something that anybody is really focused on. And so, I think that there was a lot of appetite for kind of getting rid of a lot of support positions. I mean, I remember conversations when I was at the Pentagon, back in 2004, 2005, about civilianizing a lot of roles, and food service was always, always one of those that was in the discussion. The problem is that first 90 days, right? When you move into a new war, a new theater, a new operation, what do you do for those first 90 days beyond just, meals ready to eat, MREs? Food is something that we recognize is certainly a morale factor. And eating MREs for 90, 120, but it takes a while. It takes a
Right.
while for supply chains to catch up.
Right.
As much as my supply brethren would say otherwise, that doesn't appear right away. And so you need you need trained food service people to go with a unit when they are going into a new operation.
You retired in 2018?
2020, right into
I was
COVID.
okay. So
Yep.
this sort of that maybe leads into my next question, which was, were you aware of food sourcing and shortage issues from existing contracts and suppliers to military bases as a result of being a part of the big ag processing chain, if you will?
So, obviously I was very aware in my final position of kind of how our national food system works. A great example is during the surge in Afghanistan, we would feed steak and lobster on Fridays in theater. Well, the lobster industry called up the army and said, "Please stop feeding lobster,"
Why?
because we were going through so much of
Oh my
it that
gosh. Okay. Okay.
it was actually impacting the market price of lobster. They couldn't keep up with the amount that we were going through.
Wow.
So we switched to crab legs, but so kind of understanding some of those dynamics, I think, was really helpful. But 2020 really brought to light the fragility of our national food chain. And I think it brought it home to a lot of people who would never have considered it before. Matt and I, we got into the ag space because of food. Food is my love language. I love food. I've always loved food. It's why I took the worst job in the army. But we understood that, that when you start looking at food miles, how far your food has traveled and who's producing it, and when you realize that there are four companies that control 85% of the animal protein sold in the United States. That's really concerning to me, from a national security standpoint, especially when those companies are not all American owned.
Right.
And so I think that was really brought home during COVID when people went to the stores, and for the first time in their lives, for most of them, there were empty shelves on the stores. When you have one plant in South Dakota, that can close due to the pandemic, and that controls 15% of the pork supply in the United States. That's a national security threat. And so that's what we've really kind of tried to focus on. We have to grow more farmers. We have to diversify our food system, because if we don't, there are real threats to our national security. If you look at how wars start, they start because of food and resources.
This idea of supply being tied to large companies that are subject to factors outside of our control is a concern and a consideration that I think a bunch of attention needs to start being paid to, or at least is now that wasn't in the past.
Right. And I think that you're seeing more, more questioning about, country of origin labeling, when it comes, especially to, to animal protein and honey. Honey is probably the most adulterated food in the world. It's very difficult to test and prove that it's not honey, and it's expensive. And so a lot of things are labeled honey that are probably, corn syrup
and color. Interesting.
Yep.
We had bees here for a couple of years. And I've done a few extractions from homes and, trees and stuff like that. And it is a markedly different product than what you would buy somewhere else.
Absolutely.
It's just so different.
Absolutely.
Retire in 2020. You're now in Aiken, South Carolina, 20 acres, 3-acre pond. While you were TDY, Matt comes and buys chickens, and you've got a farm when you come back.
Right.
How does that morph into what you're doing today with Project Victory Gardens? And tell us about that.
Yeah. So Matt's last day of work was, his change of responsibility was like March 24th, 2020.
Oh boy. That was like
instead of,
right at it, right?
Instead of having the entire battalion out there, like he should have, for his change of responsibility ceremony. I think there was 8 of us that were there.
Wow.
And so it was a very different way to get out of the military. And I think, we canceled our retirement parties and our retirement ceremonies. And so I think that we felt that we needed to do something to kind of, jump into whatever's next. And we had 3 teenagers at the house, and they needed something to do.
Wow.
And so, we came home from his ceremony, if you can call it that, and changed clothes, and that day started building fence. And so we fenced the entire 20 acres in, we fenced off 3 or 4 pastures. And then we got the fence done, and we're like, well, we got all this fence, now we need animals. And so, I mean, we went on sort of an animal buying spree for a while there.
Those are the best.
In summer of 2020, I mean, we came home with all sorts of, I think we had, I don't know, 3 or 4 different types of goats, 3 or 4 different types of pigs. We call them our practice animals.
Yeah. For sure.
I mean, we'd had the chickens and ducks for a couple of years by then, but we hadn't really gotten anything other than chickens and ducks. And so, we got all these misfit animals. And, with the pigs, we knew we wanted pigs. And we'd bought a whole Berkshire processed pig. And so we knew that we liked the Berkshires. And so we got, got one of those. Got an American guinea hog.
Yep.
I don't know why. Would never do it again. And then, we saw the Mangalitzas, and we're like, oh, those are super cool looking, right?
Okay.
They got the curly hair, they're fun.
Okay.
And so we got 1 or 2 of those. And so we're just doing the farming thing, right? And so we realized that we were kind of missing our people. I mean, it was COVID, everybody was missing everybody, but we had a farm, and farms were still open. You could still bring people out. And so we started doing coffee and chores. So like every Thursday morning, was open to any veteran. They could just come out and do chores, and then we'd, eat muffins and have coffee at, on the deck next to the pond, and just chit chat and tell war stories and
Wow.
whatever it happened to be. And because we really thought, kind of animal therapy, agrotherapy was the space we wanted to be in. But what we realized is that we don't need to focus on agrotherapy. Like, just getting people to the farm, you can't be mad when you're, when you're holding a baby goat, is what Matt always says. And so what we realized then was we need to get more veterans to the farm, into farming. We really want to grow farmers, because we're like the world's worst farmers. We have all the things. We have too many things because our farm is set up primarily to serve the nonprofit and not, not to serve our pocketbooks by any means.
Right.
And so we have, we have a little bit of everything, so veterans can come here and see what appeals to them. And so through that process, we made some great contacts with the South Carolina Department of Agriculture. And Matt was doing a master's of ag ed at Clemson, and he had to write a curriculum for something. And we're not the type of people who go to class and do an assignment that then you're just going to put on a shelf and never look at again. Like, if we have to do an assignment, it's going to be about something that we're interested in that we can use for our programming. And so he came up with this farmer boot camp program. And we went to the South Carolina Department of Ag and said, "Hey, can you fund this? We want to try this out." And they said, "Sure." And so they gave us a little money, and when we were still in Aiken, we tried it out, a 2-day farmer boot camp program, and it was great. And that was fall of 2020, that we tried that. And I look at some of those early participants, and every time I'm on Facebook, I see a post from this farm or that farm that went through farmer boot camp, 5 years ago almost, and they're doing great things. And to know that we've been a part of that journey is really, really rewarding for us.
How, so you said that when you were still in Aiken, are you not in Aiken anymore?
Oh, so in summer of 2021, the Midlands of South Carolina are just oppressively hot for absolutely no reason. You're not in the mountains, you're not on the coast, you're just in this hot and humid middle part. And so we'd finished chores, we were sitting out on the porch and dripping with sweat after probably changing clothes or taking showers 3 or 4 times that day. And Matt's like, "Nope, we're moving to the upstate." And I said, "Okay, I'm from Montana, so
Yeah, right.
you take me near mountains, I'm happy. That's where I want to be." And so getting nearer the mountains was important. And so we pull out our Zillow, and start looking. And I'm the more methodical of us, so I have all of these, no's set on my Zillow, and all Matt has is waterfront. He wants some water. And so, he shows me his phone and he shows me this place. And I was like, "There is just absolutely no way we can swing that one." And he said, "Oh, let's just go look at it." Famous last words, right? Go look at it. And so it was 70 acres right on Lake Hartwell, in Townville, just outside of Anderson, between Anderson and Clemson. And Matt's Clemson blood runs pretty deep. And he had converted me, I think, as soon as we met. I'm from Montana. I'd never heard of Clemson before. And so, 2015, 2016, that was a pretty good time to become a Clemson fan. Things were looking pretty good for us at that time. So, We wanted to be nearer to Clemson, so that, you know, we could kind of take advantage of everything that had to offer. And so we came up and looked at this place, and it's just a beautiful piece of property. And so we were able, you know, luckily the owner worked with us quite a bit, and we were able to get this piece of property, and it's pretty phenomenal.
That's where you are now.
That's where we
And
are.
you sort of reset up
Oh
this.
yeah, we
Okay.
moved the farm, lock, stock, and barrel,
Wow.
pig and goat, and
Okay.
it was nightmarish. Don't ever move a farm.
I've never moved farms. I've moved animals, but not a whole farm.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're still running this, it's a nonprofit, correct?
Yes, Project
Okay.
Victory Gardens is the nonprofit.
And how can interested veterans participate, and what would that participation look like today?
Yeah, so we have a lot of different programs that we're doing right now. So we were fortunate to receive the USDA Enhancing Agricultural Opportunities for Military Veterans, or Ag Vets grant,
Yeah, okay.
in 2023, and so they've really, you know, that support has really allowed us to kind of expand our capacity. So we still do the Farmer Boot Camp program. We do six of those a year. Three are 2-day versions that we do either in Charleston or Columbia, and we're looking at Beaufort, to do those. And then we have a 4-day version that we hold here at our farm in the upstate. The 4-day version is awesome, but Farmer Boot Camp focuses primarily on kind of the business planning side of things in the 2-day version on one day, and the farm side of things on the second day. Processes a chicken.
You broke up for just a second there. They get to process a chicken.
Yep, everyone processes a chicken because,
Nice.
you know, chickens are the gateway drugs to farming.
They
So,
are. Yep.
even if you're just planning on layers and not planning on broilers, you're going
Right.
to have an animal that gets, you know, sick or injured, and you need to dispatch it. And so everyone processes a chicken. We spend some time with the bees because we've really found that, you know, bees are very popular with veterans. There's a certain mindfulness that you need when you're working with 30,000 bees. You kind of need to be in that moment. You know, spend some time with the goats and the pigs, and talking about some of that. I mean, we've banded goats and castrated pigs at Farmer Boot Camp. Just so people can kind of see that, talk about some of the, you know, the first aid vet care things that you can do, deworming and injections and things of that nature. And so that's the 2-day version. And the 4-day version, we expand on the business planning side of it. So everyone it has to come up with a conceptual business plan or a real business plan if they're kind of already doing the thing. And then at the end of the 4 days, we have a pitch competition. And so they have to, you know, get up there Shark Tank style and pitch their business plan to a group of judges. And then we also see some other farms. The other thing that the 4-day version encompasses that we just don't have time for in the 2-day version is agritourism. We talk a little bit about agritourism, because that is certainly where my passions lie. I'm doing my PhD in agritourism right now. And so that's another program that we offer through Project Victory Gardens, is we've just launched an agritourism incubator program. So this year we're incubating 5 veteran-led farms in South Carolina, and next year we'll do 10. And hopefully then we can kind of package that training up, and we can offer it in other places around the United States. And to go along with that, we've established Farms of the Brave. And so that's a new marketing and branding program for veteran-led farms that have agritourism operations. And so we're enrolling farms in North and South Carolina now. And then in 2026, we plan to take that nationally.
When you say there's 5 farms that are going to be a part of this incubator for agritourism, does that look like training these farms to be able to set up a business infrastructure such that they can operate in this capacity?
So the five farms that are participating with the agritourism incubator program, they kind of the requirements were that you were a veteran-led farm, that you have access to land, and you're currently operating in at least some capacity. You have kind of at least the skeleton of a business plan. Ideally, these farms have already participated in some kind of new and beginning farmer program, whether that's farmer boot camp or the South Carolina New and Beginning Farmer Program or another curriculum-based program. So that you have, you have something set and you're moving forward, and you need to kind of figure out the right way to set up an agritourism program to bring benefit to your overarching business plan. What we see all too often with agritourism, because farmers typically don't have a lot of, hospitality and tourism background, they don't look at it from the tourist lens, they look at it from the farm lens. And so what happens is a lot of farms implement agritourism programs that work really well on somebody else's farm. And they don't necessarily think about agritourism as part of their holistic business plan. And so, like our farm, the for-profit side, Rutter's Ranch, we sell high-end charcuterie. We raise mangalitsa pigs. We drive them from South Carolina to Pennsylvania to process, and they are cured. Some of our whole muscles are cured for 8, 9, 10 months. So these are high-dollar items, right? So I don't want, I'm not going to sell them to school bus loads full of field trip kids. That doesn't add anything to my holistic business plan. So when I'm designing events, looking at the demographics that I need to get to my farm to sell this $40 a pound charcuterie, I need to do things like paint with packas or goat yoga or, goat milk soap making classes, things like that, that get the demographic to the farm that I want. And so then I need to design around that. And so the incubator program, the participants will, they're, we pay for them to join the South Carolina Agritourism Association and attend that conference. And then they'll all come here in June for a 4-day curriculum program. And we'll go through a lot of those things. So, agritourist motivations, just capitalizing on the physical and natural assets that you have at your farm. What does agritourism look like in the context of your business? Who do you want to get to your farm? And really designing experiences and focusing a lot more on experience design than most, even if you look at agritourism resources that are available, most of them don't focus a lot on the tourist side of things, that experience design and marketing.
How do you begin to get to the bottom of, or begin to put structure around a farm's agritourism revenue or business possibilities?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question. So every 5 years, the U.S. Department of Agriculture does a census of agriculture in the United States. And if you are involved in agriculture, please fill out your census data every time it comes around, because people like me do like delve into that a lot. And the problem with agritourism is there is no agreed upon academic definition. There's no agreed upon policy definition at the federal and most state levels. South Carolina has a definition, but I would say it's probably an exemption to the rule, an exception to the rule. So the way that the USDA asks about it, most producers only include things like, ticket sales and things of that nature when they're calculating their agritourism revenues. And so looking at 2022, that was about $1.26 billion. But what they're not including is direct sales. And what's being argued now is that if you're getting someone to your farm If I get someone here and I sell them my salami as a direct sale, that's agritourism, right? It's all, you can't separate it out. So if somebody is coming to the farm, UPIC is a great example. Some producers are counting that money kind of in the direct sales, and some producers would count that money as agritourism, but really it's the same monies. And so a lot of the academic side of things is really looking at direct sales and agritourism as the same thing from an economic perspective. But it's there are farms, there are century farms in South Carolina that have been saved through incorporating agritourism into their farm. There's a farm that's turning 300 years old in South Carolina this year. They talk about how they would have lost the farm if it were not for incorporating agritourism. And you have that on one end, and then you have places like Titan Farms. They grow 8% of the peaches in the United States. Titan Farms alone produces more peaches than the entire state of Georgia. So South Carolina's the real peach state.
That'll
But
sure ruffle some flat feathers.
right, well, but they incorporated agriculture. They felt an important part of their business forward, and they had 55,000 people come through their farm last fall.
That's
So
crazy.
it's phenomenal, the interest, and not incorporating some type of agritourism is probably a relatively short-sighted decision if you are in the ag space.
Especially if you're a smaller farm,
Absolutely.
right? If you're not doing 300 acres of corn or beans, right? That's a different approach. And I think fortunately and unfortunately, COVID had a lot to do with that interest and this need and desire to know more about where your food supply comes from. Are you
Well, and
familiar?
farms stayed open during COVID. Farming was essential. So,
That's
a lot of
right.
people were able to go out and seek recreation opportunities on farms that they couldn't get anywhere else.
Yeah, both recreation and supply to some extent,
For sure.
right? Are you familiar with an earlier company, earlier stage company called Land Trust? Run across these guys before. They are a company that allows farmers to open up their operations for recreational activities, primarily hunting and fishing. But it is this, it's a similar idea of additional revenue streams for producers in off season or in or on areas of your farm that are not typically used for cultivation. My understanding is that most of their work is on larger commodity type farms, but the idea is somewhat adjacent that you can make use of land that's perhaps otherwise unusable in typical agricultural fashion for other forms of revenue. And that mindset is, I think it's a really smart mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. There are obviously a lot of threats to land ownership in the United States, because there's an opportunity cost when you own land in the United States. When developers are knocking on doors and offering 30,000 an acre, and you're making, if you're a commodity farmer, you're making $100 per acre a year. It takes a long time for that $100 to add up. And so there are decisions that kind of have to be made by landowners pretty soon. I mean, the landscape is changing drastically. If you look at the number of acres that are lost every 5 years in farming, and absolutely we're becoming more efficient. We need less land to farm, but we need some land to farm. And pretty soon we're kind of going to get to that point where we just don't have it. Just in the few years we've lived here in the upstate, driving from here to Clemson, there's five new subdivisions. There's farmland for sale all around us that will go into development. And so, you know, kind of understanding that you have to make your land work for you. If you want to hold on to it, you know, you have to look at ways of making it all profitable. And, you know, whether that's farm stays, setting up glamping sites. I mean, you can set up a glamping site with no electricity, you know, no running water, and people pay to come live in a tent on a farm. You know, most of us in the military are like, why would you pay to live in a tent somewhere, especially like the summer in South Carolina? It's miserable. But yeah, I mean, people will pay you, and then they will buy your, you know, your charcuterie or your fresh fruits and vegetables, whatever it is that you're selling at your little farm stand. And so looking at some of those opportunities is important.
It's a perfect way to end this, right? Is that you have to make use of all that God has given you, right? And if you're not, you're leaving something on the table.
Yeah.
You know, this has been such a pleasure, Kara. Thank you so much for a whole bunch of your time. You're a very intelligent, learned woman, and this has been such a fascinating conversation. Let me give you the last word. Is there anything that I haven't asked you, or is there anything that we haven't talked about that we should have?
I think we've talked about all the things. But no, I mean, I think that it's just important to reiterate that, you know, look to your local producers. And Project Victory Gardens, we chose that name because in World War I and World War II, 40% of our national food supply was grown in backyard gardens. You know, if people could do that then, and we are so much more efficient now, we have so much more access to resources now, like, plant a tomato, do something, grow something in your backyard, and I think you and the world will be better for it.
That brings us to the end of part two with Kara Rutter, and the conclusion of a story that truly captures what the Vets and Ag podcast is all about. Kara reminded us that food isn't just nourishment, it's national security. Her deep understanding of the supply chain, from her time managing military food service to her current work on the farm, underscores just how vulnerable and interconnected our systems are. Her passion for helping veterans find a new sense of mission through agriculture is nothing short of inspiring. Whether it's farmer boot camps or agritourism incubators, Kara is creating pathways for veterans to not only grow food, but to grow thriving, purpose-driven lives after service. If you'd like to learn more about Project Victory Gardens or get in touch with Kara, head over to projectvictorygardens.org or connect with her on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Bissau, and until next time, stay frosty.